Now, in the last few days or weeks, I was over in Christchurch for that fairly awful business, but something I saw there did cheer me up a little. Christchurch, as you may be aware, got flattened by an earthquake in 2011, and every single high-rise building in the city either fell down immediately or has subsequently been brought down. And much of the city, in fact, looks pretty much like a rubble site. But in prime position in Cathedral Square, which Christchurch people know is the centre of the town, is a brand new building. And as I drove past it, I thought to myself, now that's interesting, because if you wanted to build a brand new building in a shattered city, and if the purpose is to bring people into the city, what would you build? Would you build an entertainment centre or a shopping mall or perhaps a big corporate headquarters? The building was in fact a library, and it's called Tūranga, the Māori name for foundation. So in a very literal sense, Christchurch sees the foundation of the cities it rebuilds as being the library. And I'm hoping that story might please our next guest, because John Vallance is the State Librarian of New South Wales after a long and varied career. And perhaps, John, I can ask you, why does a library still matter in the age of Google?
I think that's a wonderful question. I think you set me up for that question. I'm delighted to hear that very moving story about Christchurch. I can remember in another life when I was an academic going to a meeting of the governing body of my college in Cambridge, and they were wondering whether or not the college would need a library. It was the beginning of the internet age, and there was an opportunity to take over a wonderful 17th century building and turn it into a library. And in fact, the fellowship was evenly divided, and it only just got through. Today, that library is open 24 hours a day, and it's hard to get a seat. And part of my job, one of the most enjoyable parts of my job involves travelling around New South Wales visiting public libraries, because that's also part of our responsibility at the State Library. And wherever I go, I see libraries reasserting themselves and in some cases asserting themselves for the first time at the very heart of their communities. But libraries are now starting to reach into other social areas. So up at Kingscliff, south of Tweed Heads in New South Wales, you can borrow seeds that you can go home and plant in your garden, and you return the seeds when the plants grow. In Tamworth, where I was not so long ago, you can borrow cookery books, but if you haven't got the means to cook the things you want to cook, you can borrow the pots and pans. Wow. And I think that libraries should start to do things like lend tools, so that you don't just borrow the DIY books, but you can actually also borrow the means to create the physical things you
want
to do.
That's amazing, because that's a total re-envisioning of what a library is. It's a bartering point for a town.
And typically when you hear someone saying what I've just said, you may say, oh, here's another woolly-headed moron who doesn't understand the importance of books. But all of these libraries remain organised around books at their heart, around reading at their heart, and in particular, the social human activity of reading in the company of other people. And I had this idea that it's actually the responsibility of the State Library, the foundational responsibility, the responsibility at the heart of its existence, to keep the gifts of our nation in circulation. And when I arrived, it's the most amazing, wonderful place, but it's the kind of library that you can only explore properly if you know what you want before you go. I didn't know most of what was inside. Most people have no way of knowing unless they already have a fairly clear idea of what they're after. And so what we decided to do was to try and take representative parts of the collection out and put them on public show. And so in the last year, we've opened galleries which contain representative samples of our collection of oil paintings, which document the history of the nation since European settlement, manuscripts, watercolors, photographs, rare books. We're extending the library so that there'll be larger amounts of books on browsable access and so on. And so the State Library is going through a major period at the moment of regrowth, reinvention. And in an important way, I think it mirrors what's happening in our libraries across the nation. It's a very, very interesting time for libraries.
You've had the most extraordinary career as an academic, as a scholar, your Cambridge PhD. How did you as a young fellow, how did this develop in you so that you wound up with these deep curiosities about things that were probably at the time considered fairly arcane, the classics and so on?
Well, the easy answer is that I'm just a hyper nerd. But more seriously, I had the most incredibly fortunate upbringing. I have to be honest about that. I had two really wonderful parents. I had a mother who gave me my love of music, which is one of the most important things about my life. My mother worked for the Geological Survey and published a book in the year that she was forced to resign her job because she got married. A lot of people don't know that that used to happen.
Happened to my mum too.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Really is hard to believe. And my father was a geologist. He was an academic at the University of Sydney. He was a historian. He had wide-ranging interests. And I grew up in a house full of books. But I also grew up very curious. I don't know where that came from. Curious about how things work. It's the way I am. It's who I am.
You went to Cambridge. It's almost a cliche, that notion of the Antipodean oik, which I'm sure you weren't. But nevertheless, turning up in the dreaming spires at the heart of those traditions of learning. How did it hit you?
I remember very, very clearly. I mean, that's one of the years that made me, in a sense, 1980, when I arrived in Cambridge. I was very, very well prepared at the University of Sydney. I had wonderful teachers at the University of Sydney, including one man who taught me how to concentrate. That's one of the most important things I got at university.
How easy was it to learn how to concentrate?
Incredibly
and what did he teach
difficult.
We don't have that much time, I suppose, but is there a trick to concentrate?
Well, I don't know what I've learned from this man, Alan James. We read the Iliad and the Odyssey in Greek, and he was, many people thought, very dry. But he just made us sit down and read the whole of the Iliad and the whole of the Odyssey line by line in Greek. And at first I was bone-crushingly bored by it. I couldn't stand it. And then gradually it became a form of meditation. And that was the first time I think I understood the architecture of a work of literature. And it was one of the most valuable exercises I've ever undertaken.
It's a glorious epiphany moment.
It really was. So I have him to thank for that.
You went from Cambridge. You not only got your PhD there, but went on to teach there.
Yeah.
But you came back to teach smelly adolescent boys as the headmaster of Sydney Grammar School. Why on earth did you do that?
Just before I came back to Sydney, I was given the job in my college of going to visit schools around England, trying to persuade their bright boys and girls to apply to my college. And I started to get a sense that they were the kinds of communities that Cambridge wasn't. And the people who taught the girls and boys in those schools were teaching people before they'd hived off into specialties at university. They were people with very, very broad interests, rather like my own.
So you were forming children as opposed to, say, getting undergraduates.
That's right. And you had this extraordinary privilege of watching someone from the age of 5 or the age of 12 grow into adulthood. So I thought, gosh, these schools are really amazing places. I've been brought up to be rather snooty about teachers, that teachers were the sorts of people who couldn't really do anything else. And I met dozens and dozens of people who gave the lie to that. And then my father died in the 1990s, and I became incredibly homesick, just desperate for a totally unknown, irrational reason, desperate to come back to Sydney. And the only place that would employ me was Sydney Grammar School.
Tell me something, because this is a big question at the moment. What makes a boy into a good man?
I think in education generally, there's far too much glib engagement with questions of that kind of importance. If you gave me a weekend, I'm not sure that I'd be able to come up with a cogent answer to that. But what I would say, and it's just as true of women as of men, it's putting them in a community where they're not patronized, where they're taken seriously, they're treated with a demanding form of kindness. That's something as well that I learned in Cambridge, that context, community, society is incredibly important.
What was the year that made you?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me this, which is a bit inconvenient given it's the title of your program, but I've been fretting about it. The year that made me was the year in which I was conceived, and I've been remade every year since that.
Good answer.
And when I was asked to answer this question by your colleague the other day, I said 2018, because that's the last year. That's the last year in which I've been remade.
Every year we're remaking ourselves.
And it's interesting, in 2017, I retired from Sydney Grammar School after the most wonderful, I mean, that was another really defining privilege of my life working there. And I had everything I thought I wanted, and I was going to retire and become a gentleman scholar, and then I immediately got bored. And so 2017, I got the job at the State Library. And then in 2018, we've been exploring some of the things that I just mentioned to you.
Your song, I might have expected. We thought we invite our guests to come up with a song. I don't know, perhaps it'd be some piece of Baroque harpsichord.
Well, there was going to be, yeah.
But you decided to go in a different direction.
The music, I love music above almost anything else. And I listen to music all the time, and I love Messiaen and Hindemith and Bach and all the rest of this. But the piece I've chosen makes an important point to me for me about education. One of the things I think that has grown to epidemic proportions in schools in Australia is a modern version of a problem that used to afflict medieval monks in monasteries. It's called acidi or acardia in ancient Greek. And it is a syndrome that comes when you basically have all your needs met, where you don't want for anything, when you have parents who will work their fingers to the bone to pay school fees and violin lesson fees and take you on expensive holidays and so on, but you don't quite engage with things because you haven't yet found what you love, and therefore you feel a failure. And one of the most heartbreaking things that I've had to deal with in my teaching career is looking after really, really talented kids who I know perfectly well will end up finding what they love and making a fantastic contribution, but who don't want to be a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant or a dentist, who want to be a little bit adventurous. And it's not easy. It's not easy, particularly in Australia, where there are very firm and often very conservative expectations on people's shoulders. And so am I allowed to say what it is, the song?
Yes, please.
And so the song I've chosen is a song by Ian Dury and the Blockheads called What a Waste.
Hallelujah. Well, at least it wasn't Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick.
Well, I like that too, but it didn't make my pedagogical point.
Or Wake Up and Make Love to Me, which might have seemed unusual.
That make a different kind of pedagogical point. That's for another program.
Dr. John Valance, so lovely to talk with you today. And here, surprisingly, is Ian Dury and the Blockheads.
I could be the driver in articulated lorry. I could be a poet, I wouldn't need to worry. I could be a teacher in a classroom full of scholars. I could be the sergeant in a squadron full of wallers. What a waste. What a waste. What a waste. What a waste. Because I chose to play the fool in a six-piece band. First nine nerves, every one-night stand. I should be glad to be so inclined. What a waste, what a waste. Rock and roll, don't you want to stop? With stratagems and ruses, I could be a doctor with poetesses and bruises. I could be a writer with a growing reputation. I could be the ticket man at Fulham Broadway Station. What a waste. What a waste. What a waste. What a waste. Because I chose to play the fool in a six-piece band. First night nerves, every one-night stand. I should be glad to be so inclined. What a waste, what a waste. Rock and roll, don't mind.
Well, for those who think we just don't have enough Ian Dury and the Blockheads here on RN, there it was. What a waste, the song chosen by Dr. John Valance.